This week on Making Contact.
It doesn't seem to occur to anyone that Kashmir was never a part of India. It was an independent kingdom.
While the world was watching a series of terrorist attacks in Mumbai in November of 2008, the media's focus was on a standoff at the Taj Mahal Hotel. But what were the terrorists' goals? Like many of the problems between India and Pakistan, much can be traced to the dispute over Kashmir. It's one of the least understood but most important conflicts in the world. On this edition, we bring you a conversation with renowned author and activist Arundhati Roy about the future of Kashmir. I'm Andrew Stelzer, your host this week on Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. In 1948, the people of Kashmir were promised by the UN that they would be able to vote on whether to become part of India or Pakistan. That referendum still hasn't happened. Since then, Pakistan, India, and even China have been battling over control of the disputed mountainous area. Currently, both Pakistan and India control part of Kashmir, but consider the rest as part of their country as well. In the lead-up to the 2008 election, President Barack Obama said he wants to devote serious diplomatic resources to settle the dispute. Meanwhile, last summer saw massive nonviolent protests in Kashmir, calling for freedom from Indian rule. Arundhati Roy is the author of several books, including The God of Small Things, which won the 1997 Booker Prize for Fiction. She was born in India and has been a fierce critic of both the Indian and U.S. government's policies in South Asia. One of the founders of this show, and founder and host of Alternative Radio, David Barsamian, spoke with Arundhati Roy about Kashmir on January 1, 2009. This week, we present that conversation.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you, David.
You've been spending a lot of time in Kashmir, and you've recently visited there. There's been a series of elections over the last couple of months, and these elections have been heralded, at least by the mainstream press here in India, as a great referendum for freedom and democracy and a rebuke for the separatists. What is your understanding of what exactly happened in terms of the elections?
Well, you know, really the difficult thing about it is that the thing I worry most about is losing the language with which to describe what's happening there. Because it's almost as though you need a deep knowledge of what's going on there to be able to understand what happened. Because in August, even then, I was there, and I mean, all over the world it has been reported. There was an incredible, spontaneous uprising. And there were hundreds of thousands of people on the streets. This time I was there in the silence, and still I could hear that noise in my head, Azadi, Azadi. You know, the fruit sellers were weighing their fruit, chanting Azadi, the people on the buses, the children on the streets. It was as if the sky was chanting that, you know. And then...
Azadi means freedom.
Azadi means freedom. And Azadi means a lot of things, you know, freedom in a very nuanced way, because that in itself is a very contested term in Kashmir. But, and then that, you know, nonviolent uprising, and that uprising was actually presented to the leaders, you know, the quote-unquote leaders of the separatist movement by the people. I mean, it wasn't that the leaders led the movement, but the people really came and dusted off the mothballs and pulled the leaders out onto the street and presented them with a kind of revolution. The Indian government's response to that was the most harsh curfew that has ever been imposed in Kashmir. Days and days and days together, you know, razor wire, steel walls that were put in, people were prevented from moving between districts, between villages. A lot of Kashmiris were killed in firing. And the way the army is deployed in Kashmir, I don't know if I need to keep on saying this because everyone knows it now, but still for the record, more than 500,000 soldiers in the Valley of Kashmir, which somebody in America wrote saying it was the equivalent of the entire U.S. Army and the entire Marine Corps, you know, deployed in Minnesota, sort of like that. 165,000 American soldiers in Iraq, between 500 and 700,000 Indian security personnel in the Valley of Kashmir. So the way the army is deployed there, I think it would take them less than half an hour to just be everywhere in Kashmir, you know, because they are just spread out and they are patrolling all the time. So to put down this uprising wasn't hard for them in a military sense, you know. So that was August. And then there was a big debate about whether or not to call elections because everybody feared that there would be a complete boycott of the elections, which have been more or less boycotted in the past. And the separatists called for a boycott. And to everybody's shock and surprise, there was a huge turnout in the elections. And I think nobody could understand exactly what had happened. Where had that sentiment gone? You know, where was that outburst, you know, of a desire for freedom that was being expressed on the street? How did it suddenly disappear? And it was quite interesting that I started getting calls from people. And of course, the other thing is that it was very interesting in the way in which the election was called, because you know, Jammu and Kashmir has, of course, a couple of districts in Jammu are Hindu-dominated districts, traditionally very sort of. The BJP has not ever been in power there, but still there was a sort of political divide between Jammu, these districts in Jammu and the Kashmir Valley. Then there's Ladakh, there is Doda and Kishtwari. And
the BJP being the Bharatiya Janata Party, the right-wing Hindu-oriented party.
Yes. So, and there are some parts of the Kashmir Valley which are under the boot of the army. You know, if you travel in Kashmir, you see that there the villager, the army controls the inhalation and the exhalation, you know. It controls everything. So it was pretty brilliant. I mean, if you look at it from the Indian government's point of view, the way the elections were called, you know, initially, you know, these places where traditionally the army's fiat rules went to polls first and so on. But eventually, without wanting to get into too much detail to an audience that's not familiar with this, the point is that there was a big turnout, except in the cities. In almost all the cities and towns, the turnout was low, but in the villages, the turnout was very high. So I went back to Kashmir just now just to understand for myself what it was all about. Of course, the first thing that happened was that the last stage of the polling in Srinagar was due to happen, and so the police put me under house arrest, which revealed more than it hid, because, you know, you can imagine they're so frightened of anybody who has a point of view different from that of the Indian state seeing anything. Now, before the polls happened, they did a massive round of arrests. They arrested not just the leaders of the Hurriyat, which is the separatist groups, but all the workers, all the activists, all the young people who were seen to have led these protests. You know, hundreds of people were put into jail. Then a lot of even liberal Indians say that, you know, the polls were free and fair. First of all, the first question you have to ask yourself is, when you have that kind of a densely deployed army, can you have free and fair elections? Is it at all possible? election observers and liberal Indians go there, and they didn't see people being pushed to the polling booths on the end of a bayonet. So they said, oh, there was no coercion. But the thing is, now Kashmir has kind of totally internalized, the people of Kashmir have internalized what it means to live in an occupation and how to deal with it. And they do have a long-term view, you know, because they do have to survive. And so one of the things that happened was that the main party that won the, you know, that is now coming into power, campaigned very openly saying that these elections have nothing to do with the issue of Azadi. They're just about bread and butter issues. That was a one thing that happened. And these...
Sarak, Pani, and... what was the slogan?
Sarak, Pani, Bijli.
Yeah.
Means roads, electricity, and water. You know, so I think that quite explains the fact that in urban areas where people are more secure, they didn't feel the need to come out and vote. Whereas in rural areas, people... it's not actually sadak pani and bijli so much as a thin layer of protection from this occupation. You know, for example, when the SOG, which is a dreaded special operations group, goes and picks up somebody, you have to have somebody to appeal to. And that somebody is the politician. To give you an example, some people were telling me of how there's one particular member of the Legislative Assembly who keeps getting voted back to power, and his modus operandi is just before the elections, he organizes for the army to pick up five or six people, young men from that area. Then the people go and petition him. Then he goes and sort of gets them released and earns the eternal gratitude of the... You know, so these are all invisible things that happen. And there are many other reasons, you know. For example, just now all the stories are emerging that this election, more than in any other election, there were hundreds of candidates who were fielded. Each of them, you know, in a slightly feudal area, each of them has a certain sort of number of relatives and friends who come and vote for them. Because the main thing in these elections was the government was very keen to have a big turnout, regardless of what happened, to show that this is a democracy. Now, each of those people, in fact, the day I left Kashmir, all these sort of defeated independent candidates were having a press conference in this restaurant called Adu's, talking about how they had all been paid by the intelligence bureau, you know, sums of money to stand for election, and then some of them weren't given that money, so now they're disgruntled. Then there are other issues. For example, there's this group of renegades known as Ikhwanis, former militants who turned into very dreaded killers working for the government. Some Ikhwanis, and sometimes Ikhwani's sons, were standing for election, and people went out to vote against them so that they would not be represented by them. So there are a number of factors, but it's true that even without these factors, people did come out and vote. And for me, the way I see it is that people realize that they're lying on a bed of nails, and these elections are like a little thin layer of sponge over the bed of nails, you know, a way of getting by, a way of continuing to live. And they're not in any way going to permanently solve the problem of Kashmir. You know, what the Indian government has done over and over again over the decades is to do this kind of crisis management, sweep things under the carpet, and then hope that it'll go away, and then it resurfaces in a different way, in a different form. So I was there when the sort of free and fair press of the mighty government of India arrived there, you know, to gloat over these elections. You know, people who knew nothing about Kashmir were coming there to give the commentary, saying the most absurd things about how this was the end of the freedom movement and so on. And this, to me, the saddest thing was that I felt, you know, all the people I spoke to, Kashmiris, without exception, said, we've done this to ourselves, you know. And I felt that this sort of psychological war on them, this lowering of their self-esteem, this forcing them to participate in tactics of survival, which eventually make them despise themselves, was really the deepest form of colonialism, you know. And someone said, you know, we feel like Shias at Muharram, no, when we whip ourselves and then we draw our own blood, and then the Indian sort of propaganda machine comes and puts salt in our wounds. And that's how a lot of people said they felt. But I think it's very difficult to understand the full extent of this, except that what people really want is being thwarted again and again and again. Everybody is speaking on behalf of people. And as a citizen of India, I feel uncomfortable with that. I feel that we can't gloat about doing this to somebody. You know? Of course you can manage it. Of course India will always be able to manage it because it's a small valley. But then again, I don't think that it'll always be possible to manage it, because eventually I do think that the price of holding down the Kashmir Valley, which was being paid mostly by Indian soldiers who are mostly poor people from India who don't count, was suddenly paid by, suddenly that price was paid by the Indian elite in five-star hotels in Bombay, you know. And that puts a totally different spin on things.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast from radioproject.org. We now return to a conversation on Kashmir with Arundhati Roy and David Barsamian.
You write that the Indian military occupation of Kashmir makes monsters of us all. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that? In what way?
Well, I mean, in all these ways that I've described to you earlier, that it makes us complicit in the holding down by military force of a people. It makes us complicit in the propaganda. It makes us complicit in the lies, you know. And eventually it makes us people who are unable to look things in the eye, you know.
Right, but then you say that it allows Hindu chauvinists to target and victimize Muslims in other parts of the country.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that happened in the early 90s in Kashmir was that when the elections were rigged in 1987, which led to the movement in Kashmir, which existed beforehand, suddenly become a militant movement. And there was young men coming, rising up with arms, young men crossing the border to Pakistan to train, come back. One of the fallouts was that was the exodus of the small community of Kashmiri Pandits, who were Kashmiri Hindus from the valley. They were a very, very small minority, but a very powerful minority, because, of course, the king who signed the accession document was a Hindu ruler over Muslim subjects, and therefore this small minority of Hindu Kashmiris was a powerful minority. But because they feared for their safety, rightly so, and because the government at the time, the governor, Jagmohan, quite unforgivably said that the government couldn't protect them, they sort of facilitated the exodus of these Hindu pundits from the valley. The poor among them ended up living in refugee camps in Jammu. They still live in refugee camps in Jammu. And as I mean, you must remember that it was exactly at the time that a lot of things were happening geographically in this area at the time. It was, you know, the Taliban coming to power in Afghanistan. The Hindu, the BJP, LK Advani leading this Rath Yatra towards the demolition of the Babri Masjid and the rise of Hindu chauvinism. So these Kashmiri pundits were wielded like a club by Hindu chauvinists in India and used to whip up this anti-Muslim sentiment. And of course, that orgy of hatred, that whole manifesto of hatred of the BJP eventually led to the breaking of the Babri Masjid, the coming to power of the BJP, the genocide against Muslims in Gujarat, the bombings in Bombay in retaliation for the Babri Masjid, the genocide in Bombay against Muslims by the Shiv Sena, and a whole rise of this kind of ugly, divisive politics. And, you know, so if you were to question the average Indian, the only thing they know is that there are terrorists in Kashmir. They wouldn't be able to tell you that 60,000 or 70,000 people have died in this war. They wouldn't be able to tell you about the dubious morality of India holding on to this place. They say, you know, Kashmir is Atut Ang, an Atut Ang, which means an inseparable limb of India. Yeah. It was.
And there's also something close to 10,000 people that have gone missing.
That have disappeared. Yeah. And the point is that it doesn't seem to occur to anyone that Kashmir was never a part of India. It was an independent kingdom, you know. And so even today, when they gloat about the elections, if you say, why don't you have a referendum as was promised by the UN, they say, oh, that's an old cliche, and, you know, how can you ask that? And, you know, things have moved on from then. So,
well, tell me, with the people that you spoke to there, what do they think of Pakistan?
I think the when I was there in August, you know, I've written about it in this piece that you referred to, along with Hum Kya Chahte Azadi, which means what do we want? We want freedom. There was an equal amount of Jive Jive Pakistan, meaning long live Pakistan, 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 Pakistan. And yet I think that if you question people, there were many reasons for that. One was that what they think of Pakistan is, to put it in some crude way, if there was a referendum where people were given the option of India, Pakistan, or Azadi, I imagine that an overwhelming majority would say Azadi. If they were given only an option between India and Pakistan, I think, I'm no one to say this, but I'm just saying my gut feeling is that Pakistan would win hands down. But, what India says is Pakistan's fueling of terrorism in Kashmir. I think people see as Pakistan's somewhat self-serving, but self-serving yet very important support for the freedom movement in Kashmir. People understand that it's self-serving, but people still see it as support for what they see as a freedom movement.
And there's awareness also that the state there is basically not only exploding, but imploding.
I think that there is awareness of that, yet I think, you know, the real question is that what people have experienced is the brutality of the Indian state, you know. So at this point, that is foregrounded for people in Kashmir, you know. it's a bit theoretical to say, but maybe it'll be worse with them. They say, then that's our problem, you know. Why are you worried about our problems? Because I suppose to be, in Kashmiris don't, even when they are not being political, if you go around Kashmir, they ask you, have you come from India? They don't consider themselves Indians, you know. But it's been a very difficult time for Muslims in India, you know. So to imagine that people would be, Muslims would be longing to be a part of India is a sort of, when they don't have to be, the hallucination. I mean, Indian Muslims have a completely different problem from Kashmiris, you know. Indian Muslims have a different issue here because they have to live here and they have to find a peace in this almost fascist atmosphere, you know. But Kashmiris see themselves as people who have a choice. They don't have to put their heads down and kiss ass. I mean, you have to find a different way of saying that. But
ultimately, you conclude this article that with India needs Azadi from Kashmir just as much, if not more, than Kashmir needs Azadi from India.
Well, I think that was there was something almost prescient there. You know, I wrote this, I don't remember when it was published, but August or September or something. And I did sense that there wasn't any possibility of India managing the Indian state. And it's wrong for me to just say the Indian state because Indian society in places like Gujarat and Maharashtra, even in Bombay, you know, to continue to marginalize such a vast minority. I mean, only in India can 150 million people be a minority, you know? 150 million Muslims in India, and to continue to bulldoze this population in Kashmir, eventually all that can come out of it is destruction, you know? All that can come out of it is people wanting to take you down with them. If you push them to a stage where there is no possibility of any access to justice. And even if 99% of them decide to put their heads down and suffer, 1% is enough to destroy life as you knew it.
That was author and activist Arundhati Roy speaking with David Barsamian in New Delhi, India, on January 1st, 2009. Roy's latest books are The Checkbook and the Cruise Missile, written with David Barsamian, and An Ordinary Person's Guide to Empire. That's it for this edition of Making Contact. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Or you can get our podcast at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Tina Rubio, executive producer, Khan Pham, associate director, Elena Botkin-Levy, production coordinator, Keisha Thomas, Asma Musaini, and Patty Restiano, interns. And I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.